For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm Red Sale.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and coming up on today's show,
Frances Leirdet explores old wounds and new beginnings in the follow-up to her international bestseller, We Must Be Brave.
Rebecca Stott transports us back to derelict London, 100 years after the Roman withdrawal from Britain, in her new novel, Dark Earth.
All that and more coming up in today's Read On. Frances Leirdet scored an international bestseller with her 2019 novel, We Must Be Brave. It was set in the fictional Hampshire town of Upton, to which she's returned for her eagerly anticipated follow-up. Think of Me navigates between war-ravaged Egypt in 1942 and England during the 1970s to peel away the layers of a relationship built on hope and secrets. Frances Leirdet, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
We first meet one of your protagonists, James Acton, in 1942 when he is an RAF pilot flying Hurricanes on the eve of the Battle of El Alamein. Can you tell us a bit more about him and his war record?
Yes, I can. Before the war, he was training to be a priest. So he never actually became a priest. He just pretty much completed his training when he was thrown into the war, like many other young people at the time. And he became a pilot. And he fought most of the campaign, the North African campaign, which went back and forth from Egypt through Libya and back again for many, many, many months, probably as many as almost 3 years, if not more, before the decisive blow was struck in conjunction with the Americans and the Allies were able to push through Tunisia and up into Sicily, by which time he was captured. So my protagonist has been a pilot, a prisoner of war, that is, and finally a priest.
This is the 80th anniversary of the battles of El Alamein. So it seems very appropriate to be revisiting this story now. And you have done an enormous amount of research. I was one of those children who used to build model aeroplanes, and I never realised that the Hurricane was actually made out of wood with linen stretched over it. There are some wonderful nuggets of information. You clearly got well into the research.
Absolutely, yes, I did. I loved it, and I used that part of the construction of the Hurricane in a conversation between James Acton and the young lady he's recently fallen violently in love with. And so he tells her some facts rather awkwardly and stiltedly about the Hurricane, since she's asked. And she finds it very hard to believe, and she thinks that he's just kidding her. But they actually were. The back part was made out of linen, Irish linen, which was stretched over the wooden fuselage, the back part of the plane, anyway, back of the fuselage, and doped, covered with resin, and then painted. And it was actually very good because it meant if a shell hit it, the shell would tend to go through. I'm not minimizing the damage a shell would do, but it was very much quicker to repair a Hurricane than it would have been a Spitfire or any metal-bodied plane in the same time, because that would have to be hauled right back to the mechanics and re-paneled or tapped out or whatever, whereas mending a Hurricane was much easier and quicker.
It does, however, give us a sense of the precariousness of life as a pilot during the Second World War. And it's something that James feels keenly. And yet, when he meets Yvette, this young Levantine woman, a local of Alexandria, she gives him a reason to live. And yet she too is in a precarious position. She is part of a dying civilization. The Levantines built this wonderful trading empire that made the Mediterranean the center of culture for centuries. And yet all that's coming to an end.
Yes, that was right. And I think the war perhaps slightly held that up for a short while. But afterwards, the changes began to come thick and fast. And Alexandria was a city of all Mediterranean peoples, really, from the Levant, as you've said, but also from North Africa, from Greece, from Italy, from all cultures, Jewish, Greek Orthodox, the Middle Eastern churches, Catholics. they all played a part in producing this very individual civilization. But I think what happened really was Egypt as a whole began to feel a very strong sense of national identity. And the change was really spearheaded by Gamal Abdel Nasser when he brought forth a program of Egyptianization. And this meant that many people who were of this Alexandrian culture felt they weren't welcome. And in fact, it went further with some appropriations of businesses. And it was a time where people recognized that the heyday of their lives was over. And so most of them just left. Some stayed, but many, many of them left and went to America, Canada, Australia, Paris, Greece, all over the world. You can find this Alexandrian diaspora, and you can now find the children and grandchildren of these families living in these far off places.
You have James and Yvette meet in rather gorgeous old Alexandrian settings during an aerial bombardment, which really just signals that everything is beginning to crumble around their ears. And this is a relationship that was forged in war, when the future was a hope rather than an expectation. And the suggestion is from the very outset that not every relationship made under such circumstances is going to be a match made in heaven.
Yes, I think that's true of, you know, many encounters during the war. There were a lot of marriages at the time on which I based James and Yvette's marriage, and many of them were between RAF and Alexandrine women. They are very interesting to follow. I followed a few of them through history, and I felt quite a sure basis for James and Yvette's marriage. I think the real challenge for James and Yvette came after the war, when Yvette was transported from her relatively luxurious life in Alexandria to post-war England in a small house in a southern coastal town. And her life really was turned completely upside down. She was living with a priest, obviously, who'd never been paid very much. And so they really had to eke things out. And she did it for love of him. And she said herself, "I couldn't have done it if I'd been any older." She attributes a lot of her stamina to her relative youth, but also she knows that she did it because she loved James.
Yes, and you peel away the layers of their marriage in a dual narrative. We have James reflecting from the 1970s, but threaded throughout the story are extracts from Yvette's own memoir. She has died by 1974. She has been dead for a decade, but we can see her disappointment, but also her deep love for James and her self-doubt, which actually juxtaposed with James's wavering faith is very powerful, but neither of them really communicate.
Yeah, they go through a period of very much non-communication, and it happens after they have a tragedy. They lose their first daughter, who is stillborn. And we hear from Yvette that James completely shuts down. He seems unable to offer her any real support or even to really mention the child's name. And Yvette finds herself utterly alone, and she has to struggle through this. And her struggle takes her in kind of a very interesting direction, and one which actually starts to imperil her whole marriage. I think this lack of communication between bereaved parents is actually quite common. My husband and I, we lost our first daughter in the same circumstances as Yvette and James. So I drew on my own experience. And luckily, we were always able to communicate. But I work as a support worker for the SOUNDS charity, which is the stillbirth charity. And I have met a lot of people who've just found it really, really hard afterwards to keep those channels open, because very often one half of the couple is grieving, emoting, doing a lot of crying, seeming to break down. And in response, the other half, and it's not always, you know, the father, can be very inward, turn absolutely inward and just not go anywhere near the grief. And quite a lot of people say to me, "I can't break down. I can't approach this grief. because if we both break down, what will happen? So it's the sort of dynamic where one party gets more and more sad and more broken, and the other party becomes more and more obdurate and monolith-like. And it's quite a difficult cycle to break. But it certainly happens with James and Yvette.
We rejoin James in 1974 when something inside him has told him that he needs a change. And so he's taken up a new parish and, well, the vicarage is falling apart round his ears, and it allows him to start questioning his own faith and address the issues that he buried long ago when he and Yvette did lose their child and Yvette's own death.
Yes, that's right. He does face a lot of challenges at this time. And as we watch him try to settle there, he actually, settling is the wrong word, because almost immediately he's very unsettled by finding a scarf which has been abandoned in his church on one of the pews. And as he picks it up, he's seized by the certainty that he's seen it before and he knows it intimately, as if it's been next to his late wife's skin. And he just can't shed the feeling that it's something to do with her. And that scarf sort of wafts through the narrative and keeps us wondering what's going to happen. And at the same time, we see him try to forge new relationships and also to try and solve the mystery of the scarf. And at the same time, Yvette is telling us more and more about what went on in the past. And so these two narratives dovetail at a point where we learn what happened with Yvette. And we see that James is in an absolute crisis. And as you say, we see him very much wavering and lost and not really being able to call himself a man of faith. And so the creaky old vicarage comes into its own at that point.
It does.
Give everything away.
Yes, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but the new parish is in Upton, the location of your previous book, We Must Be Brave. And the central character from that book, Ellen Parr, makes a reappearance in this book and again demonstrates her wonderful humanity and just how important communication between human beings, especially at times of crisis, is.
Yes, I think she does. I had enormous fun going back into my previous book, We Must Be Brave, and looking at the conversations where she first meets James Acton, because they have a couple of very significant conversations. So I was able to replay these conversations in Think of Me from the other side. So it was fun to see in We Must Be Brave, Ellen feeling rather gauche and slightly old maidish as she meets James at a party. And then to see that James at the same time is feeling like he needs to go and lock himself in a cupboard because he's saying such ridiculously stupid things to Ellen. So both of them are kind of seething with this anxiety and insecurity as they look at each other and find what they're looking at to be very, very appealing indeed. So it's kind of understated, but at the same time, it was fun to sort of work that around and see it from the other point of view. And Ellen, she is a rescuer. She just has to be very honest, and she tells him everything about her own broken heart. And she just says, look, this is me, look at me. And at the same time, she does it in a perfectly practical and matter-of-fact way without any kind of, what one might say, melodramatic emotion. There's none of that with her at all. And she's very gentle, and he finds himself, he's not seduced in the sexual sense, although he does think she's very attractive. It's more of a seduction of the mind as well and the soul and the possibility of solace, I think, she represents to him initially.
Did you feel driven to continue Ellen's story? Was she a character who walked back into this book, or did she appear halfway through the writing?
Well, at the end of We Must Be Brave, the story is told from a person who knew Ellen when the person was a tiny child. And so Ellen has been telling this person, Pamela, about her life subsequently. And so she does mention at the end of We Must Be Brave that she married the vicar, she married James Acton, and had a whole other marriage towards the end of the latter part of her life. And I can say this, it's not really part of the plot or anything. It's just something that happened. So when I finished We Must Be Brave, I found that James Acton didn't really figure very much in earlier drafts at all. He had a different name. And then I got more interested in him and how he worked and what he was doing in the book. And I realized that he was quite significant. And then I thought, yes, obviously he likes Ellen and something must come of this. So the whole idea of writing Think of Me was for me to actually deal with what I thought about James Acton. I really, really needed to work that out and give him this kind of sense of being between two lives, to being in crisis and being able to finally move on, which I find very, very interesting as a topic. And I think it's worth adding that consolation can sound rather soothing and balm-like, you know, applied to great sorrow. But actually, I think it has to be really worked for, and they do work for it. And James pushes himself forward and he finds himself in absolutely new territory. And I think I love that at the end of the book, to find someone in completely new territory they're unfamiliar with. They don't know where it's going to go. Ellen herself also admits she's frightened about starting this relationship. And so I love to feel that both people are moving forward into like a new country. And it takes courage to do that because it's not familiar. It's not the old things that you loved. It can be uncomfortable. And I think that's quite important for me when I'm writing.
Now, James is given wonderful voice in the audiobook version by Nicholas Guy Smith, and Renata Friedman does the same for Yvette. I know that your writing being available in audio is particularly important to you because of your own family history, but you must be very delighted at having got to such wonderful narrators.
Yeah, I'm really, really over the moon. And it was such fun to talk to them and about what was happening. And I remember my grandfather years ago, he lost his sight several years before he died. And he loved speaking books and things. And in those days, they came with a clunky old tape recorder and huge tapes from the library. And everything was sent like that, you know, in parcels and so on. It was very different. But it was such a lifeline for him to be able to be transported into another world. And I've always thought about being very interested in the audio versions of my own books. So I loved the whole process of choosing Yvette was fabulous. I had several Yvettes to choose from, and Renata was just wonderful. And Nicholas was just perfect from the beginning. And I wrote to him and to thank him for his performance. And he wrote back saying how much he liked it. And when he voices, there's a character called Archdeacon Frobisher in the book. And he said that he loved voicing Frobisher, whose voice was quite sort of waffly and difficult to do. And he was very moved by Frobisher's account of how he himself, Frobisher, found his faith during the war, marching westwards from a prison camp. And he got abandoned in the snow and he thought he might well die. And Nicholas told me that he was in tears while he read that. And for me, I just love it when a reader gets totally behind a character and can totally see what they're like and literally just give voice to them in a very, very special way. So I completely love that performance. And I listen nearly nonstop to the audio of Think of Me. I couldn't stay away from it for very long. I thought it was wonderful.
Why do you think? Frobisher chortles. Boredom, man. Look at you. You were an RAF pilot, a prisoner of war. That was 30-odd years ago. I can't disguise my astonishment. It's hardly relevant now. I beg to disagree. He rocks back in his seat, enjoying himself. I've seen so many like you. You're one of a whole generation, all ex-services, who signed up for the priesthood at the end of the war. And what were you doing? Arming yourselves to fight another good fight. Think of theological college. All that cold water and discipline and ardent celibacy. Certain similarities to a military training camp, no?
Nicholas Guy Smith, narrating Think of Me, written by my guest, Francis Liardet. Now, Francis, we talked earlier about the research that you did for this book. And I know that part of the research actually goes back many years to after you left Oxford and went to work in Cairo as a translator for a Nobel Prize winning author. So no pressure there. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I can, yeah. So it was great. The Nobel Prize winner is Naguib Mahfouz, who I was very honoured to meet, and I translated one of his books, which was a fantastic experience. But my actual kind of baptism into translation came from an Alexandrian writer whose name is Edouard Al-Harat, and I managed to translate two of his books, which are in English called City of Saffron and Girls of Alexandria. He was a modernist writer of huge, huge talent and ability and breadth. And in these books, he manages to weave into his narrative, which is essentially that of a young man, a young Coptic man, boy and man, growing up during the 30s and the 40s of the last century in Alexandria, but at the same time, reading voraciously, learning voraciously, and in come all these fabulous tales from poetry, from Thousand and One Nights, from the Greek history of Alexandria, from the Arabic history of Alexandria, all sort of brought into these fabulous, almost dreamlike sequences and visions that he has of his city. And nowhere have I read things which gives you more of a sense of the sort of palimpsest of memories that is the city of Alexandria, which exists for all time, really, in the art and the strivings and the memories of the people. It's quite an extraordinary read. And so I count myself very privileged to have translated these two books.
I certainly was fascinated to be taken to those dying days of the Levantine and those Alexandrian nights of the 1940s. I wondered whether you might revisit them in novels to come.
I don't know. I find the concept very, very fascinating of that city and of other similar cities, which are essentially ports. You know, they're kind of liminal places, and they're places where people come and go and where people form a civilization and a culture quite different from the culture around it. And they can be anywhere. The Mediterranean ones particularly fascinate me. And I might write again about it, but I'm not sure it would be that particular Alexandria. There may be another place that I would want to go, either deeper and earlier into the city or perhaps somewhere else entirely, but where I can take the same sort of feeling of it.
Well, I will look forward to reading about wherever you take us. But meanwhile, Frances Liardet, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of Think of Me. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Red, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Both Think of Me and We Must Be Brave are available from the RNIB Library. And Frances will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB. See differently.
The last time we welcomed Rebecca Stott onto the show, it was to discuss her memoir, In the Days of Rain, which won the 2017 Biography Award. But Rebecca is also a highly respected author of historical fiction. Her latest novel, Dark Earth, takes the reader back into one of the most obscure periods of our history, the years following the Romans' withdrawal from Britain. It's an era that fascinates Rebecca, and researching into it has taken up much of her past 5 years. Rebecca, welcome back to Read On.
Good morning, Red.
At the start of the novel, we learn that it was inspired by an archaeological find at a Roman villa in London. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, so it's a brooch. You imagine a large button, I suppose, like maybe 2 inches across. And this was found in 1968 in the remains of a Roman villa and bathhouse on the north bank of the Thames, and it was found by a man called Peter Marsden, who I met and interviewed. And what was interesting was that the reason that he was on the site was because he was doing a very, very quick dig. One building had been demolished, another one was going up. It gave him a chance to really have a look at that villa and the bathhouse, which he knew was interesting and exciting. And on the site, he found this brooch, and it was an ordinary looking brooch. He'd seen loads like it. But what was thrilling to him was that it was an Anglo-Saxon brooch. So he knew it had been dropped by an Anglo-Saxon woman. This was a woman's brooch. As she walked across the fallen roof tiles of the bathhouse. So he knew the number of people who went into the ruined city after the Romans abandoned it. For almost 400 years of the city's abandonment, almost nobody went in. Nobody really knows why, but they think probably the people who farmed in the area around it, Anglo-Saxons and native Britons, they probably thought that the ruins were haunted. They would certainly have been dangerous, totally overgrown. There would have been wild animals in there and so on. So here he had found an Anglo-Saxon brooch. This was evidence that at least one person had gone into the ruins and had dropped her brooch there. The brooch had fallen down between the fallen roof tiles. So the roof would have been gone of the bathhouse and she would have scrambled across the roof tiles. So when I came across that brooch and that story, so it sits on the wall of the Museum of London on an almost blank wall. And it's on an almost blank wall because it's one of the few bits of tantalizing archaeological evidence we have about the life of the city in its 400. I think of them as kind of sleeping beauty years. You know, this was when the extraordinary mile-wide city built of stone just was sitting there crumbling. The brooches are really important. For me, it felt like a portal. Here was a story. We were never going to know it. We're never going to know what she was doing in there, why she dropped her brooch, what took her in there in the first place. Was she on the run? Was it a love tryst? But once I'd asked myself that question, it bubbled away in my head for an awfully long time. And it was almost as if the brooch was the talisman or the magical object that took me into the world that became darker.
And this world that you create is around two sisters, Isla and her sister Blue. They're both mixed race, part Saxon and part Iceni, or another term for the Iceni tribe who Boudicca ruled. And they are living on an island that they've been banished to, opposite Londinium, but away from the rest of the Saax tribe, with their father, who is a smith, a sword maker.
Yeah, so the sword maker, you know, we know in this period, because often the forges in these small wooden-built camps would have been built on the outside of the camp, sometimes even outside the walls. And I guess in some ways that makes sense. You know, you've got a very big fire in a forge. You definitely don't want your buildings going up. But then there would have been fires in all of the huts, so it's not a special fire. So people think that the blacksmiths may have been regarded as having magical power. Certainly they could do extraordinary things with metal. They could transmute things using fire. But they were also incredibly valuable to anybody who wanted fancy swords, because there weren't very many of them. So my smith has been banished to the island, partly because he's regarded as possibly having dark arts, but also because the local overlord wants to control the means of his production. He wants the fancy swords that this smith is able to make. And of course, because my smith is aging fast, he has crippled hands, his daughter Isla, the older of the two sisters, has started working with him in the forge, which in this period, and we don't know this for certain, but for the purposes of my novel, I had a sort of ban on women going into the forge, all kinds of beliefs and superstitions about women cursing blades, about passing on bad magic into the sword. So Isla starts with a secret. She knows how to make the fire tongue swords. call them fire-tongued swords. They're pattern-welded swords that are very, very beautiful Anglo-Saxon swords, many of which have survived. Isla can make these, and that gives her, in a sense, a superpower, but also means that people want to control her too.
And as you say, this is very much an age of superstition and also an age of jockeying for position between the different tribes. And there's a recurring question in the early chapters of the book, who do you belong to? And as we said, these two girls are mixed race. And there's tension, there's a power vacuum in the wake of the Romans having left. And control of weapons and control of tribes is absolutely at the heart of the society that they live in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So many really interesting historical novels are set in periods of transition, when one culture is being overtaken by another, where we get the sort of eddies of historical tension as things are rapidly changing. And we know from the archaeological record that this period is a period where, after perhaps 100 years after the Romans left, people were living very much hand to mouth. There was no surplus, you know, no grain stores, no wine coming in, no olive oil from the Romans anymore. So people were just surviving. And I think, and we don't know for certain, but probably cooperating with the incoming tribes, the Anglo-Saxons, because they had skills, you know, it's like, what do you know about farming? Can you help us do this bit of planting better? And then we start to see the beginning of surplus after about 100 years, about the time of my novel. And what I mean by that is people are able to store grain. They're able to make more fancy jewelry. We start to see what you might call consumption again, conspicuous consumption. And that's when we start to see the rise of what I call the overlords, you know, local rulers who take power, get soldiers around themselves, and then start to tax the local people, not for money, because there's still no coins, but for grain, for meat, cloth, etc. So this seemed to me a really interesting period where you've got these overlords vying for power. They want land, they want soldiers, they want to be able to tax the people. And that, yeah, it creates a kind of power vacuum. And the swords are really important in that, because if you've got a pattern welded sword made by your local smith who is highly talented, you can make alliances with those swords, because as the swordsmith who I worked with told me, a pattern welded sword was a bit like owning a Maserati or a garage of Maseratis. You know, it showed that you had bling. This was serious bling. So yeah, the smith, the swords are all part of the kind of armory of the display of power for someone like Osric, who's my overlord.
So much of history is told from a male perspective, from a fighting perspective, but actually we can also see from what we were talking about earlier, from the discovery of this brooch, that smiths make decorative objects and also swords as well. And you're exploring the place of women in this society as well, because obviously they were making up 50% of the population and providing a vessel for the population to come.
I was really struck when I started doing research in this period, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with the material I was researching, but over and over again, I was really frustrated with the books I was reading, because the history books, the archaeological books, even the historical novels set in this period seemed to be all about men on horses with swords fighting each other. And I was, where are the women? Again and again, I remember a couple of times where I just threw the book at the wall, because it's like chapter after chapter, and none of these historians or archaeologists or whatever, you know, they were writing in good faith, but somehow, perhaps because they were men, they were just not looking for the archaeological evidence. They weren't asking questions about the lives of women. So then the question for me was like, what happens if you put women at the center of this period of history? We know so little anyway, but what if you go in through the brooch? What if you go in through a community of women, a couple of sisters? What does the world look like? So I very deliberately made the vantage point all female. So there are men in the novel, and some of them are very good men. There's a wonderful character called Caius, who is an important player in the book. But by and large, I wanted to see the world through women's eyes.
We can hear in your voice just how exciting you have found your, 5 years of research for this book, I think, since we last spoke, actually. And it wasn't just studying books. You actually went out on archaeological digs and also went to a forge and learned all about Saxon sword making.
Yes, that's right. I am a bit of a geek, and I did want to not just read about swords, which is fine. You can read a lot about how swords were made and the different styles and so on, but I needed to smell what a forge was like. I needed to feel the heat, the sounds. So I contacted various people and said, is there anybody who's an expert in Anglo-Saxon sword making methods? And everybody said, oh, you've got to go and talk to Hector Cole. He is in his, I believe, either late 70s or early 80s. He's given up his entire life to working out, just by making them, how Anglo-Saxon smiths made the pattern welded swords. So he's just experimented and experimented. So I wrote to him and said, can I come and visit you? And he said, yes, of course. I went down there and we had a day in the forge. And it really was like a kind of poem. He was amazing himself and he created a beautiful forge, but he was also able to talk me through the colours of the fire to show me that for an Anglo-Saxon smith, they wouldn't have a thermometer to be testing how hot the charcoal had become, but they would be watching the very careful gradation of colour as the fire, as he put it, got its heart in it. And he'd just say, look, it hasn't got its heart in it yet. It's not the right blue. Watch, 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 watch. And he got me to look really, really closely at the colours and reminded me that a smith without the technology of today would be using his nose and his eyes to see or feel all the things that he needed to know. And of course, that's where Blue's name comes from. You know, it seemed to me that for a smith watching the fire, the colour of blue is the point at which the fire gets its heart in it.
It's a wonderfully sensual book. It is just full of the smells and tastes of the surrounding of the two girls' world. And it is brought beautifully to life by Hannah Morrish. And I believe that there is a very good reason that she has been chosen as the narrator.
Yeah, no, Hannah Morrish is my daughter. She is an amazing actor. So I've learned so much from her, from watching her. And in some ways, my character Isla, who's the main character of Darker, is based on her. And Blue is based on Hannah's sister, Kezia. The two of them are incredibly close. They have an amazing way of seeing the world. And they helped me develop the novel in its early stages. I gave it to them to look at. So when the publishers came to me and said, can you suggest anybody who you would like to have read this book? I suddenly realized it had never occurred to me, but the obvious person to read it was Hannah. She is Isla in a way, has always been Isla in my head. So I said, can I, would it be all right? And they said, of course, that's a great idea. They looked at her CV and of course, you know, she's a distinguished Shakespearean actor. So they said, oh my goodness, it'd be amazing to have her do this. So she went into the studio and she texted me from the studio on the last day and she said, Mom, I'm giving myself chills. And I think what she meant by that was that by the end, she was beginning to feel so immersed in the world of the novel and the excitement of the ending that it was actually bringing her out in the goosebumps.
Isla and Blue are sitting up on the mound watching the river creep up on the wrecks and over the black stubs of the old jetties out on the mudflats, waiting for Father to finish his work in the forge. Along the far riverbank, the ghost city, the great line of its long abandoned river wall, its crumbling gates and towers, is making its upside down face in the river again. Something's coming, sister, Blue says. Look. Isla looks. The wind has picked up. It scatters the birds wading on the mudflats. It catches at the creepers that grow along the ghost city wall. It lifts and rustles them like feathers.
Hannah Morrish, narrating Dark Earth, written by her mum and my guest, Rebecca Stott.
Now, Dark Earth is also an exploration of storytelling. Isla has learnt that stories can get out of hand, and once you've started a story, you have no control over where it might go.
Yes, that's right. That did seem to be really important right from the start of the book, because, of course, Isla and Blue are exiled to the island with their father, and they know that one of the reasons that has happened is because Isla has been telling stories about her father's powers, that she has seen him fly at night and so on, in order to protect the forge and the camp where they grew up, and that the stories she had told in order to win fights over the local boys and so on had got seriously out of hand and had resulted in some ways in them ending up exiled. So Isla has learnt that lesson really early, and I think what I came to understand as the book went on is that she comes to see that you can control stories. Yes, stories can get out of hand, but you can use them, the kinds of stories that people tell against you, these women are witches, the kinds of stories that people tell about the community of women that Isla and Blue find in the ruined city, that they can use those stories as a form of power. And I think that is something that they increasingly use as the novel goes on. And this is, of course, a period of not just gossip. Gossip sounds so kind of trivial, but, you know, where power is not just in the sword. Power can also be in the kinds of superstitions that people might believe. And if you can control magic and superstition and spectacle, then there are ways in which you might acquire and hold power as women in a way that's different from the way that the men hold power.
Yeah, this control of the narrative, I mean, it's something that you actually also explored in your memoir, In the Days of Rain, the way that people's lives are controlled by tribes or religious sects because there is a book that supposedly sets down the rules and regulations that will govern the members of that tribe, or there are a set of rules that have been instigated by a holy man. Did that inform your writing of Dark Earth?
Yes, it did. Red, you are a very astute reader. That's a very deep reading of the book and absolutely bang on. I mean, I am who I am. I'm made by that childhood that was very controlling and was very much, you can't do that because it's not in the rules, etc. Brethren way of life was incredibly controlling. And so I'm always interested in that. So yes, there are connections between the two books that seems unlikely, but there are connections. And yeah, this is a period of enormous cultural diversity. People who stayed after the Romans left, who might have come from North Africa, for instance, people digging up Roman cemeteries in London now are able to prove just extreme cultural diversity. People coming from all over the Roman Empire. And we've got the Anglo-Saxons coming in, people talking different languages, believing in different gods. So we've got huge heterogeneity. And it seems to me that if you were living in a slightly fearful way, or if you were an overlord wanting to impose power, that imposing homogeneity might be something that you would want to do. You belong to me, you will wear my colours, the fashions that belong to my tribe, not the tribe you were born into. So that seemed a really interesting set of power dynamics to explore, how people move from cultural diversity into enforced assimilation.
There's also a playfulness in the title of the book that you chose as well. We are led to believe that the era following the Roman withdrawal from Britain was the Dark Ages, and that nobody really did very much, basically, I suppose, because nobody really wrote anything down. And yet you're using it to illuminate these profound truths about ourselves and showing just how rich that layer of dark earth is when it's mined by archaeologists and storytellers.
Oh, that's beautifully put. Yes, and dark earth also, of course, refers to the layer of... So if you're an archaeologist working on Londinium, which is the Roman layer, if you imagine London now, it's like layer after layer after layer. If you go down far enough, you'll go through the medieval layer and come to the post-Roman layer and then back to the Roman layer and then to the Iron Age layer, etc. But if you get to those 400 years of post-Roman London, the period where it was derelict, what archaeologists find there is dark earth. And it's black, kind of loamy soil, sometimes like 2 meters deep in places, and other places it's only a few centimeters deep. And for a long time, everyone was like, what is this? Did the Anglo-Saxons bring soil into the city after the Romans left? Did they do market gardening in there? Like, what is this? But they now widely believe that this dark earth is simply what the derelict city compacted itself down into. If you imagine all of the leaves falling into the ruined city, roofs gone and so on, it's like a giant compost heap. And now we've got this extraordinary dark earth. Well, it seemed to me that that was just the most perfect title for the book.
Well, Rebecca Stott, thank you so much for sharing some of that richness and mystery with us today and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dark Earth joins a selection of Rebecca Stott's other books in the RNIB library.
This is an RNIB talking book. History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The first talking books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303-123-9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. At the top of the show, we heard from Frances Leodert, exploring old wounds and new beginnings in the follow-up to her international bestseller, We Must Be Brave. And it's now time to return to Frances for the books of her life.
Frances, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Oh, very definitely there was. I have to go for Jane Eyre. I think everything about that book just spoke to my soul in a way that was almost ridiculous in a kind of fairly youngish teenager living a pretty comfortable and not hugely eventful life in Hampshire in England, to be so transported by this story of wild moors, driving rain. And Jane Eyre, I think I was absolutely enamoured of from the first moment I met her reading behind the curtain in her safe place. This child who had nothing in the way of affection, was totally starved, was brutalised and abused in a way that speaks to so many people. And her life was so hard and she was so plain and she had nothing. And in that respect, she is the ideal heroine that anyone can identify with. And to contrast her against this very powerful man who has everything that she has not is a gift. And I think it's just so beautiful and it's so brilliantly done. And the other element that I really love is the fact that it also goes into the new territory I was talking about earlier, where Jane returns and finds Mr. Rochester once again, and he is ruined. He has been blinded. And yet she is able to forge this new life with him. And suddenly he is what she needs and she is what he needs. And they are finally together. And I just think it's so true and it's absolutely brilliant.
Have you ever heard anything from your father's kinsfolk, the heirs? Never in my life. Well, you know, Mrs. always said they were poor and quite despicable. And they may be poor, but I believe they are as much gentry as the Reeds are. For one day, nearly 7 years ago, a Mr. Eyre came to Gateshead and wanted to see you. Mrs. said you were at school 50 miles off. He seemed so much disappointed, for he could not stay. He was going on a voyage to a foreign country, and the ship was to sail from London in a day or two. He looked quite a gentleman, and I believe he was your father's brother. What foreign country was he going to, Bessie? An island thousands of miles off, where they make wine. The butler did tell me. Madeira? I suggested. Yes, that is it. That is the very word.
Lucy Scott, narrating Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Oh, I think a book that really comes to mind for this is The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. And I have several friends who are huge Edith Wharton fans, as am I. They maintain, you know, she's far better than Henry James and she's been ignored and la la la. I don't really go in for joining factions myself, but I do completely adore this book. Because its description of an unattainable love is just so perfect. It works so well. The heroine here is so beautiful, poised, unattainable. The man is caught between his wife, who up to the minute that he meets this second woman, has been entirely satisfied with everything he has, including his engagement to a very pretty young woman of his social class. And then along comes a second woman and just shatters everything. And I just think it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
You really think this is due to some intentional interference of Lawrence Lefferts's? He inquired, turning to Archer. I'm certain of it, sir. Larry has been going it rather harder than usual lately, if Cousin Louisa won't mind my mentioning it, having rather a stiff affair with the postmaster's wife in their village or something of that sort. And whenever poor Gertrude Lefferts begins to suspect anything, and he's afraid of trouble, he gets up a fuss of this kind to show how awfully moral he is, and talks at the top of his voice about the impertinence of inviting his wife to meet people he doesn't wish her to know. He's simply using Madame Olenska as a lightning rod. I've seen him try the same thing before.
Gretel Davis, narrating The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, very much so. I've recently read a book by Elif Shafak, and it's called The Island of Missing Trees. And this book has been described as a kind of paean to the beauty and diversity of Cyprus, an impassioned work, original in the ways it retells and reconstructs painful pasts. Well, one of the most beautiful and original ways that it does this is to give a whole chunk of the narration to a tree. So the tree actually grows in the middle, literally up the middle of a tavern. And so the tree essentially sees everything. It sees the early lives of these people, and then it sees the war coming and all the frightful conflicts that have shaken Cyprus at this time. And I just thought it was brilliant. I really, really loved it. And the tree is sentient in this narrative. It listens to the most extraordinary things that it understands. Things like the footsteps of a lost soul, for example, treading across the bridge of Sirat, thinner than a strand of hair, sharper than a sword, straddling precariously the void between this world and the next. And it's just a brilliant device because it's a wonderful way to soar into the most poetic language describing the beauty and also the soul, really, of Cyprus.
Once upon a memory, at the far end of the Mediterranean Sea, there lay an island so beautiful and blue that the many travellers, pilgrims, crusaders and merchants who fell in love with it either wanted never to leave or tried to tow it with hemp ropes all the way back to their own countries. Legends, perhaps. But legends are there to tell us what history has forgotten. It has been many years since I fled that place on board a plane, inside a suitcase made of soft black leather, never to return. I have since adopted another land, England, where I have grown and thrived, but not a single day passes that I do not yearn to be back. Home, motherland. It must still be there where I left it, rising and sinking with the waves that break and foam upon its rugged coastline.
Daphne Kumar and Amira Ghazala narrating The Island of Missing Trees by Elif Shafak, which is available from the RNIB Library, as are many of Elif's other books.
Frances Liardet, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners today and for being a guest on the show.
Red, I've absolutely loved it. Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.